Good evening, everyone. I want to thank everyone for coming. I want to acknowledge Rabbi Leiner, who joins us, the Menahel of YBH, and many other Mechanchim, Mechanchos, and community members, community leaders who are with us this evening. Just want to take a moment to thank Bonnie Shear, Rini Tovbin, Naomi Bodek, Chava Kurtz, for all of their help in putting this evening's program together, and of course, Avrami Grohl, for whom he's responsible for many of the programs in our shul, but in particular this one is certainly a labor of love, as so much of his professional life is devoted to Jewish history, Jewish memory, and these types of issues, and so for him to be able to bring our community this opportunity is particularly special, and we thank him for all of the work that he put in order to make this evening come together. I would like to welcome to our community Sonia Klein. It is an absolute honor for us to have you here. I don't want to give away your whole bio because I'm sure that's what you want to share with us. But suffice it to say, I think I'll mention that after the war, she settled in the greater Buffalo area for an extended period of time and was involved in founding the Young Israel there, as I understand. And as I understand it, that shul now bears the name Joseph and Sonia Klein Synagogue, Young Israel in Buffalo. She now lives in Brooklyn, and I believe there is a program that she is regularly involved with on Yom HaShoah, but chose to come here tonight in recognition of the fact that, first of all, New Jersey is better than New York. And second of all, more importantly, her sense of connection and emotional connection to the Young Israel. And so it's in that spirit that we welcome you to our home and extend to you such a warm and appreciative sense of Hakaras HaTov, of gratitude for you coming here this evening to share your words with us. This is probably one of the most difficult introductions that I have the opportunity to make throughout the year. How do you set the tone? How do you share some words so that all of us could put ourselves in a frame of mind for what this evening is really about? So I want to just share with you very, very briefly that in Jewish life, we encounter something called Eidus. Eidus is the Hebrew word for testimony. And in the context and the landscape of halacha, of Jewish law, testimony, eidus, takes two shapes. One is when someone essentially recalls information, objective facts, dates, times, circumstances, and essentially corroborates events that took place in the context of some sort of judicial framework. And based on that information, we adjudicate some particular circumstance. And that type of eidus, that type of testimony, is really a testimony of recall. It's a testimony of memory. It's the sharing of data, of information. But there is another type of eidus, there is another type of testimony that exists within the corpus of Jewish law. And that is the testimony that takes shape when we find ourselves as certain existentially transformational moments of personal identity. The witnesses that stand at a wedding are not there because they're standing there to report some particular set of circumstances, some particular set of information. The witnesses, the testimony of a wedding, are part and parcel of the halachic vehicle that transforms two individuals from an individual identity towards a coalesced, shared, partnered, unified trajectory of life. And these two elements of testimony of eidus, really we encounter them throughout halacha. There is the eidus that we just recall what happened, and there's the eidus that effectuates a transformation in the essence of who somebody is. And I think that when we think about what it is that we've gathered here tonight to do, we've gathered here tonight not only to hear of the story, of the history, of the personal autobiography of our esteemed guest speaker, not only to hear of the testimony of the places and the events and the circumstances, which are certainly so essential and so critical to enshrine within the consciousness of the Jewish people, that that is part of our history and something that penetrates deep within inside our sense of personal and national identity. But there's another dimension to tonight's testimony as well. And that is, it has a transformative effect upon us as a community. It connects us to the larger legacy, to the larger story of Am Yisrael, of the Jewish people. I so often share, I think I might have even shared it at Shabbos HaGadol, that when someone wants to become a Jew, someone wants to convert, we tell them not only the good, but we also tell them the tragedy of Jewish history. And we do that, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, because you don't just get to become part of the Jewish people by internalizing the mandates for our halachic observance and all of the foundations of our philosophical beliefs, but you become part of our Jewish people when you own the story and you become part of the legacy and part of the continuum that ultimately comprises the history of Am Yisrael. So tonight it is my great honor to be able to introduce Mrs. Sonia Klein to share with us her edus, her testimony, not only of what she went through in her life, so we have a greater sensitivity and appreciation, but so that we could really leave here transformed as people and transformed as Jews, as more sensitive, as more appreciative, as more recognizing of the world around us and what we have, what we could have had, what we don't know, what we no longer have, and what ultimately we're all about. And that sense of community, that sense of transformation is very much part of the edus, of the testimony of this evening. So it is now my privilege to call upon Mrs. Sonia Klein to share her presentation with our community.
I made it. Hi. My name, you know. And before I really go into my story, which would take probably 1,000 hours, I spend 1,800 days being in the Warsaw Ghetto, 4 concentration camps, and a death march. I multiplied it by the hours, and it's 44,000 hours. Now, how do I take 1 hour out of 44,000 hours to tell you my life story? However, I am here not only because I want to tell you my life story. I'm here because I carry a message with my life story. Now, where do I start? Excuse me. 1,000 hours could not tell what I went through. So, it's not easy for me. I may seem calm and collect, but I am not really. It's not always there. But when I talk about it, I relive it. So it gives me quite bad nights. So why am I doing it? Because if not I, we Holocaust survivors, who? And if not now, when? It is a must for everyone to know. Difficult to comprehend, yes. Because I, who went through all this, am asking, how on earth could I do it? My life was not in order, and my stories are not in order. But I want to tell you just a little bit. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay. I was born in Warsaw, Poland, to wonderful, wonderful parents, and had three siblings. When the war broke out, I was 14 years old. So now you can figure out how old I am, and I'm thankful to Hashem for the age he gives me. If you're good in math, you'll figure out how old I am. If you want me to tell you, I tell you. I had the most wonderful early childhood years and was a very happy young girl until I reached my teenage years and the war came along. And there was never a normal moment since then. Like I told you, my parents were only 40 years old. I have a sister, God bless her, with whom I survived the entire time being together, which did not happen in one in tens of thousands. And we are here together till this day, thanks to Hashem. I wanted to be a teacher when I was growing up. I had a dream, I wanted to be a teacher. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. In 1939, the war broke out. 1940, in the fall of 1940, Hitler's murder machine took place, and it took some time to get all the Jews into ghettos. Why? Because from the ghettos, they could be rounded up easier than going through a city and looking for them. Ghettos were formed in all big cities in Poland. As a matter of fact, this week is the 74th anniversary of the uprising of the Warsaw Ghetto. And my sister and I were the last transport from the Warsaw Ghetto, 74 years ago. There were 35,000 Jews that were left in the ghetto at the time of the uprising. And we knew before the uprising what's going to happen. So my father of blessed memory and 10 other people were building a hiding place under the foundation of the building. Now, the building was a place that belonged to my uncle. Our home was destroyed the first day of the war. We lived in the suburbs. And we were lucky to get a room in my uncle's development that was half bombed out. And this is where we were hiding. However, when we heard that the final solution of the ghetto is coming, my father and 10 other men have built a hiding place under the foundation. We were probably able to survive there for a year or so. However, it didn't happen. We were found out, but we didn't give up this easy. There were 10-year-old boys with homemade little bombs that were jumping out windows onto big, massive German tanks. They didn't scratch the tank, they lost their lives. We had a designated sound to get in and out of the hiding. It was a knock. Somebody had to go out because provisions we did not have for more than a couple of days. So every two or three days someone had to go out to get some food. Whether the person that went out was followed, or whether the person was tortured, we do not know. There was a knock on the sidewalk, and we opened, and we saw the very famous German boots. We said they're not going to take us alive because we knew where we were going. However, life is a very precious thing. When we are drowning in a lake or in an ocean, we hang on to a straw. Is the straw going to save us? No. But the little hint of hope maybe is going to save us. The ghetto in itself was the most horrible thing. I told you, 44,000 hours. I do not want to fill your head with atrocities, because the human brain tries to forget what's painful. I am here to leave a message for you to remember and not to forget. To tell you about all the atrocities, impossible. Impossible for me to tell you, and impossible for you to comprehend. Why was it so important for the Nazis to have the ghettos? So they can round us up quickly. And being the Warsaw ghetto housed approximately 50,000 people. When we were pushed into the ghetto from Warsaw, there were about 400,000 people. How can 50,000 people absorb 350,000 more people? Impossible. The streets were full of corpses that couldn't even be covered with a newspaper because it was impossible to bury so many people so fast. We were told that if we report to certain places, will be taken to work and given food. Now, when you starve and it's winter and you're freezing, we knew perhaps that's not so, but we did report. Not we as per se, but people did report. In 1942, we found out from one person who heard of Treblinka. One person came back from Treblinka under the closing and told us where our work is. Now, Treblinka was an exterminating camp, not a working camp. When we found out where our work is and where our food is coming from, naturally, this is when we started to hide again. But when we found out, we had two choices. The ghetto was burning on both sides of the street. It was a choice not to get out from the hiding and be burned to death, or get out and maybe live. We went out. There were 75 people in hiding, and we went out. Out of the 75 people, my sister and I are the only survivors, thanks to Hashem. You know, I'm standing here and talking and reliving it, and I know I'm asking myself, how on earth could you do all this? So I understand how difficult it is for all of you to even understand, even if you really want to. However, let me say this to you. Hitler taught us one thing. In 1933, when he came to power, Germany was in very bad economic need. And like all politicians, he promised everyone what he's going to do. No one listened. But in 1936, when he was ready to start his murder machine, he had a ready army. So what does it prove? That you plant something in people's mind, it may not take off right away, but it does take off eventually. Now I am planting something in your mind. And as difficult as it is to really comprehend, it happened, and we must know about it. Our loved ones live now through us. Once we are gone, they must not and cannot be forgotten. And this is why, as difficult as it is for me or for other Holocaust survivors to talk about it, we must not be silent. I, in my darkest hour, when it was the biggest if in my life, if I will ever survive, I made a vow to myself, if I survive, I will not be silent. Silent led hate and silent led to murder. And we cannot do this again. If we say never again, that means never again, providing that we are not silent. Now let me go back to my life. From the Warsaw Ghetto, we were taken to Majdanek. Who heard of Majdanek? Oh, good. My whole family was taken to Majdanek. When we came to Majdanek, there were people from our building with children. So we said, well, perhaps we will go to work. The perhaps did not last long enough. Within one day, I lost everyone. And thanks to Hashem, I was left with my sister. My parents, I told you, were 40 years old. My little brother was 10 years old. You know, friends we choose. Family we inherit. We have no choice. You marry someone, I like it, I don't like it, you're my family. One thing I can tell you, one should never ever know what it means to be left without anyone. Love your family and appreciate your family no matter how you feel about them. Because to be left alone is the worst thing that can happen to anyone. No parents, no siblings, no grandparents, no aunts, no uncles, no cousins, no one. No one. In Majdanek, we were about 4 weeks. My mother was pushed to the right with myself and my sister, but she wouldn't let go of the hand of my little brother, who was 10 years old, so she was sent to the left. We didn't know that there was a gas chamber there. The following day, when we were taken to work in the fields, I saw my father through barbed wire and asked my father where is mother. So he said, in block number 5. I believed. But when we went to work, digging in the field and came across human bones, we knew there is no block 5. The following day, I saw my father again through the barbed wire, and I asked, and at that point he knew that we know, he shook his head. We were in Majdanek 4 weeks, my sister and I. And after 2 weeks being there, my father came close enough to the barbed wire where the SS didn't see him and gave me a little watch and a ring. And he's probably from my mother. And he said, give this to the SS woman. There's a transport going out of here in a week. You must be on this transport. What do you mean, you must be? A rat was free. We were not. However, I managed to give it to the SS woman, and she put us on the transport. There was a transport that went out with 1,000 women. We didn't know where we were going. This transport went to Auschwitz. Birkenau, Auschwitz. The 20,000 people left in Majdanek went all into one grave. Is it easy for me to talk? No. Is it easy for you to understand? No. Because how can human beings be as evil to other human beings? And I don't care if it's based on color of skin or religion. It's impossible to believe and impossible to tell about the atrocities that happened. When we got to Auschwitz, our heads were shaved, our numbers tattooed. Almost died from the tattoo. It's not today's tattoo. This is about 700 needles. I don't know how the tattoos are done today, but no 700 needles. And I was asked many times, can't you remove it? Yes, I could from the arm, but I can't remove it from the brain, so what's the point of removing? It's always there. Can be at the most joyous occasion, a wedding or any joyous gatherings, it's always there. We looked at one another and we didn't recognize one another. We were put in rows of five, 1,000 women, 200 rows of five. My sister and I were the fourth row from the left. An assessment came and said, who is the shoemaker here? Now, she was 15 and I was 17. Was I a shoemaker? I don't know who raised my hand. Hashem, my parents, I do not know. And I pushed my sister to raise her hand. We were taken to work to what was called a shoe commando. What was the shoe commando work? We were placed in Birkenau, which was about 3 kilometers. Now, 3 kilometers is how many miles? 2 miles. We were placed. The barracks were in Birkenau. The work was in Auschwitz. Now, the gas chamber was right in the middle. And to go to work, because we worked with shoes, meant that we had to walk barefoot on gravels that were either burning from the heat or frozen from the cold without shoes. That was the payoff for working with shoes. We walk every day, and the tracks where the trains were coming into the guest chamber, we passed every day. One day, I looked back. A train came in from Hungary, straight to the guest chamber. And I looked back and I saw a bride in her bridal gown getting from the train straight into the guest chamber. Now, how does one forget this ever? How can this be forgotten? What was our job? We were placed at small tables, 10 to a table. We had to take apart the shoes from the victims. Every time I took a pair of shoes in my hand, big shoes, small shoes, baby shoes, black shoes, white shoes, my heart stopped because I knew where the shoes came from. But if you want to live, you have no choice. As we were sitting, my sister and I, and in a moment sometimes thought maybe if we survive, we would never go back to where we were born. Because in good times, we always looked back to see if someone has a stone to throw at us or something else. So we were sitting with another person that we adopted as a sister because she had family in Argentina, and she said, if we survive, we will all go to my family in Argentina. So now we are three sisters. The world, the people, not the world. The world is beautiful, the same world. Green grass, blue skies, the people in the world, silent. The people in the world knew in 1942 what's going on. Silence. I told you, silence and hate led to murder. October 44, the Red Cross started to intervene a little bit to find out if what they hear is so. So what did the Nazis do? They made an example camp in Auschwitz in the city, and they took three commandos, the shoe commando, the clothing commando, and the ammunition commando, and placed us in a nice building. We had bunk beds. We had bunk beds in Birkenau without even a straw mattress. Who's talking about a pillow or a blanket? But we had it in Auschwitz to show the Red Cross that it isn't as terrible as they are told. The only thing is, in Birkenau, we had to stand every day a roll call. Now, if the assessment did not count right, we could be standing for 2 hours naked. This in itself was already enough to bury you until the count came close to what it was supposed to be. So when we were taken to Auschwitz, to this example camp, The roll call was in the basement. However, for us not to feel too comfortable, Dr. Mengele, who heard about Dr. Mengele? Dr. Mengele was there with us every single day. Now, they had a quota. Every single day, so many people had to be murdered. If I would have this little marks that I have on my hand now, I wouldn't be standing here. We were still in the nude, but it was inside. This was October 44, around Yom Kippur. The food for the day, do you know the size of a hot dog roll? This was a piece of bread the size of a hot dog roll and a small pad of margarine. This was the food for the day, period, nothing else. Can you tell me how on earth could we survive this? Only Hashem knows. I have no answer. I have no answer to it. I am asking how. Now, the American army and the Russian armies were closing in. In January 45, we were taken out from Auschwitz, given a tiny sweater and a pair of boots that were above your ankle. And this was it. From there we went to Ravensbrück. Who heard of Ravensbrück? You did. Ravensbrück had, you know, there were 6 million Jews that were murdered. But there were 6 million non-Jews that were murdered. That's why I say murder should not be by color of skin or religion. We picked up on our 6 million, where the world didn't pick up as much on the other 6 million, and now it became a Jewish Holocaust. We were in Ravensbrück about 3 weeks. They were already disorganized. We did not get this piece of bread or the pad of margarine. They brought a kettle of potato peel soup. If you were strong enough and could grab something, you had it. Otherwise, you didn't even have this. From there, we were put on a train, where we were bombed by the Americans because they didn't know who was on the train. And we were sent to deeper into Germany to a camp near Leipzig. And they didn't want to accept us because they knew that the war is coming to an end. The war could have been finished 6 months prior to when it was finished, but Hitler still had 500,000 people to murder. So how could he finish the war? How could he surrender? He still had 500,000 people to murder. From this little town, Taucha, near Leipzig, we were taken on a death march from February till April. There was no longer anything. No food, no water, nothing. If you bend down for a little bit of snow, you got shot. I personally could not see any longer because day and night was the same to me. If it wouldn't be for my two sisters, my sister and the adopted sister that dragged me, I wouldn't be here. We were liberated by the Americans in April 45. The American kept us for about 2 weeks. We were taken into a school. It was a bumped out bridge that they were carrying us over the bridge. From the 1,000 people that were on the death march, I do not know if 100 survived. Now, you know, I am asking how on earth could I? How about you? You can't. It's impossible. But I'm planting something in your mind and you will not forget. The Americans took us into a school and they had food for us, family style. You know what family style is? You put a bowl of mashed potatoes, a bowl of scrambled eggs, or whatever else on a table, and people help themselves. But we were so starved that whoever got a hold of the bowl of whatever ate the whole thing and died because our stomach could no longer take food. So, they gave us portions and they kept us for about 2 or 2.5 weeks. And they said, you are free. That's nice. The shoes, the little boots that were given to me in Auschwitz froze to my skin. So when I was liberated, they had to be cut away with my skin. How can I forget it? I live it every day. Quietly, but I live it every day. Am I standing here, come and collect? Yes. Why? Because you must know. You must know. And not all of us can bring themselves, including my own sister. If you ask her a question, she will answer you. But to get up and speak about, she can't. So, Rabbi, in our Yom Kippur Machzor, it says, that a person arranges the thought, but the speech comes from God. Is that correct? Okay. So maybe I was given the speech. Now, we were liberated in the middle of Germany. You know, nothing in this world happens by chance. Everything has a destiny. Nothing happens by chance. When we were told that we are free, there was a displaced persons camp in the middle of Germany, and it used to be a jail, and this people were put in there, perhaps 1,000 people, I'm not sure. The city of Leipzig was given over to the Russians when they divided Germany, when the Americans and the Russians divided Germany. And we found ourselves, the three of us, three Russian soldiers at our door in the middle of the night. Well, if they wouldn't have to give up their guns when they entered, we wouldn't be here. My adopted sister ran down to the security and asked them to come up, and they asked the soldiers to leave. We got up and we marched the street. because we wouldn't dare go back there. When it got about, I don't know, it was about 5 o'clock in the morning, we saw a Russian captain who looked Jewish. It was like taking your life in your hands to ask him if you are a Jew. He said yes. And we told him what happened. He says, you cannot go back there. You must get out of here. So there was a border in the forest that divided the two zones, the Russians from the American zone. And we were able to get back to the American occupation. Now again, we are free, on the street. No shoes on my feet any longer. No food, no money. Free. We're walking down the street. Along comes a train with coal, black coal, heating coal. We look at the train. The train stopped. We look at the train, the three of us, and look at the train. We didn't have the strength to kill a fly. How do we get up on the train? We didn't know where the train was going. We didn't know how long the train will be going. We got up on the train. What strength, where we took the strength, I do not know. We were on the train 5 days. Again, nothing. No water, nothing. The train came to the German-Austrian border in a small town, Mittenwald. A beautiful town in the middle of the Alps. We had to get off. Like I said, nothing happened by chance. My future brother-in-law-to-be happened to be at the train station that day. What he was doing there, I do not know. Hashem sent him there. That's all I can say. He looked at us, and he looked at us, and he says, who are you? You're not black, you're not white. Who are you? So we told him what happened. He said, oh my God, you didn't eat or drink. Never mind eat, you didn't drink for 5 days. I take you to a place, a restaurant, where you can have something to eat. We are walking down the street. And again, it didn't happen to be, it was meant to be. As we are walking, my future husband-to-be is standing in front of a house and knew my brother-in-law because 1,000 men were liberated in this town in Germany. They were taken there to be killed. There wasn't enough time, so they were liberated there. And there was a displaced persons camp, but my husband lived in a house with a German couple. There were some righteous people, unfortunately not enough. There were some, but not enough. This couple took in the three men, brought food to the door, gave them a room, brought food to the door every morning, knocked on the door, left the tray with food, and left. So my husband was outside and asked my future brother-in-law, who are the girls? So he told them, he said, oh my God, but all the restaurants are closed on a Wednesday. Come up to our house, we have some food. How did they have food? There were three men, the three of them together did not weigh 150 pounds. But there was an American battalion stationed in the town, and they went to the Americans and they said they want to work. So the Americans said, you want to work? They couldn't even lift a finger. You come here every day, you eat. When you gain a little weight, we'll talk. They went there, they ate, they took food home. So we went up, and this is how I met my husband. Now, you know, nowadays, you love a person or you are in love with a person and you get married, right? I'm meeting a stranger that I know 1 week I'm getting married. Why? I need a pair of shoes and I need something to eat. Is this a reason to get married? No. But let me tell you something. Hashem knows what he is doing. I had the best marriage one can really and truly wish for. I had in one person an image of a father, because my husband was a little bit older than I, the pictures are there. An image of a father, a husband, a lover, a good father to a child, my advisor and my best friend, my teacher and my best friend, all in one person. So doesn't Hashem know what he's doing? That's why I had to come to Mittenwald on this train going to nowhere to meet this man. Now, unfortunately, we had to live in Germany 4 years before we could come to the United States. We didn't have anyone to sponsor us. We were sponsored by the Federation and the Hayas. But until then, it was not easy to live with people where you knew that they might have killed so many, and everyone behind your back said, we didn't know anything, but we didn't know anything. But they murdered 6 million without knowing anything. My husband, may he rest in peace, was the first person after the war to build up a business in Germany. In the United States, we need license for certain businesses like liquor and maybe others. In Germany at the time, you needed license for everything. Now he needed shoes. The three of us, the three sisters, had no shoes. So he went to a shoemaker, and the shoemaker said, yes, I would make you shoes, but I have no leather. So where do you get leather? Oh, they had everything to a T till this day. Every little thing is recorded. He told my husband where to get the leather, but he needed a license. So my husband went to the mayor of the town, and do you know what the mayor said to my husband? The mayor happened to be just a Nazi. He says, why don't you go back where you came from? So my husband said, what did you say? I didn't come here on my own free will, but I will live when I want and not when you want. So you will never have anything here. My husband says, okay, so we see. P.S. My husband went to the place where the shoemaker told him to go, and the same story. By the time he got there with his friend, adopted brother, by the way, my husband was from Yugoslavia, and I was from Poland. Why do I bring up this? Because the Yugoslavian, the Serbian people, not Yugoslavian, because they were, I think, four different kinds of people there. The Serbian people were very nice to the Jews. The Jews worked in Serbia in copper mines, and the Germans walked them to Germany, and the Serbian people said, don't go with them, they're going to kill you. So the Jews said, why? What did we do? P.S. They killed them, okay? My husband wanted to go back and tell some of the people how they thanked them. I didn't want to go back to Europe because I swore that I would never step foot on that soil. Well, In 84, against my better judgment, I went. We couldn't find a grave. We couldn't find anything. Well, we're in the United States. First of all, I can't thank the United States for giving us a country and giving us a possibility and a way of starting again. One day, my son was 5 years old. We were here already. We were sent to Buffalo, New York. We were here already, and he was playing with Cowboys and Indians. When I stepped on an Indian, I had to attend the funeral. And I was playing gin rummy with some of my friends. It was around Hanukkah time. A couple days later, he comes over to me and he says, "Mom," I said, "Yes, honey." "I don't want a number." "What?" "I don't want a number." "What number?" "I don't want a number like you and your friends have." Now he's 5 years old. What do you tell a child? I asked the facilitator, "What do you tell a five-year-old child?" I said to him, "Honey, don't worry, you will not have a number." My son is a professor at the Northeastern in Boston, intelligent, educated. It took him 30 years to come to terms with what he thought. A lot of our children have guilt feelings. Why? They were not there because we couldn't help you. But you were not there. How could you help us? But they have guilt feelings. Now, dear fellow Jews, what can I tell you? My story is like hundreds of other stories. I'm just asking or saying to myself, it's a miracle that growing up under circumstances like this, that we are still as sane as we are. Now, I am often asked questions, how do you hate? I said, no. I have all the reasons, but no. Because hate and silence led to murder. We must never forget this. Can I forgive? I don't know. Although we say that if we want Hashem to forgive us, we have to forgive. But this is a different category all in itself. So why am I doing what I'm doing? Because like I said, once when we are gone, you, your children, and future generations must remember the 6 million, if not the 12 million. And this can only be done with you because we are, unfortunately, up in years. And this is why I'm also asked, how come you have such a positive outlook? If you want to live, and you don't thank Hashem for every day that He gives you, who are you going to thank? Why am I here? I was asked many times, so where was God? God is way, way above us. Where were the people next to us? Where were they? That's why you must not be silent and you must remember our loved ones. Thank you for having me. And I know that right now it is difficult for you to comprehend, but I know that I have planted something in your mind, and once you plant something in people's mind, they don't forget it. Thank you. Are there any questions? I would gladly answer a question.
Do you want to take a few questions?
Yeah. Sure. But I need you here because your meaning is just not so good.
Okay, we're going to take a few questions. If anyone would like to ask some questions, just as a reminder, a question is an inquisitive wonderment. Searching for an answer. We're going to try to stay away from our own speeches. So if you have something to ask,
Don't hesitate, even if it's a personal question. All you need is to start. Once you start, here's a question. Oh, but a young man.
Is it true they had bands, music playing in the front of the camps when you got to the camps?
I don't remember any music. I don't. I did see pictures of Auschwitz from a teacher who came back there recently, and it isn't the Birkenau Auschwitz that I saw. It is a museum now, but young people still should go. Don't be bashful, come on.
Was there ever a moment where you felt like giving up?
I think I told you before. When you drown and you think a straw is going to save you. No. Because if I would give up, and not have the positive outlook, I couldn't really. I had a very happy life after I lost everyone. Everything doesn't mean anything, everyone. But I had a very happy life. Hashem gave me a happy life. And no, at all times I said, I told you, the biggest if in my life, but I always hoped, perhaps.
Were you in Warsaw during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising?
We were the last transport from the ghetto. My sister and I were the last transport from the Warsaw Ghetto, where we went to Majdanek. Yeah.
The uprising,
that right now, after Pesach, is when we were taken out from the camp, from the ghetto. This is 74 years.
You were there. You saw the uprising.
Yes. I told you. The kids were jumping and didn't scratch a tank, but gave their lives. But people said, well, we didn't fight. We didn't. What did we fight with? Our lives.
My mother was from Lutsk, and she always said that the neighbors, the Polacks, tried to kill them before, and the Ukrainians, where she was, before the Germans even got there. Do you have a similar experience?
His mother, who's a survivor, was a survivor, said that the Polish people and the Ukrainians tried to kill the Jews even before the Germans came. Was that your experience?
Not only before the Germans came. Poland is the only country that killed 500 Jews after the war, because the Jews came back to towns where they left a little something. And not to give it back to them, they killed 500 people. We were always afraid. Even in the normal times, we were afraid. It's true.
Where is your adopted sister today?
Where is your adopted sister
today? My adopted sister, we never went to Argentina. My adopted sister was in Canada. because she was not well after the concentration camp. And then she moved to the United States, and we were together, and she passed away about 3 years ago.
Have your parents been named after, and have you been to Israel?
My husband, may he rest in peace, is buried in Beth Shemesh in Israel, and the bottom of the stone, do you know the stones in Israel?
Yeah.
The bottom of the stone has the names of the parents.
No, I meant our living relatives in your family named after.
Are there any children and grandchildren named after?
Yes.
Of everything you spoke about, what is the one most important message that you want everyone to leave here tonight with?
You must carry on the memory of our loved ones forever. And it is up to you young people and generations to come. And this is why I am here. And believe me, tonight and tomorrow night and maybe another night I won't sleep, but it doesn't matter. As long as I left a message with you of what has to be done once we are gone, my not sleeping doesn't mean anything.
Thank you so much for sharing with us. We're told that when you go through a nisayon, a terrible, terrible nisayon, it's really only the person themselves that can understand what message Hashem has for us, why it happened. Can you share with us if there's anything that you've come to understand, the why, the positive, that why this happened?
She's asking if, after going through all of this, and you talk so beautifully about how Hashem is always with us, if you have any thoughts as to how you, in your life, deal with the question of why all of this happened.
When it comes to this, we have a lot of questions, but we have no answers. Hashem knows what He's doing. And I have to leave it to Him. I have to be thankful to someone that I am here. And who is the someone? Hashem. I have a lot of friends that came from very religious homes and believed in nothing, and I understand. I have friends that believed in nothing and became strong believers, and I understand this too. No, I don't have the answers. I personally feel that I am here because Hashem wanted me to be here. You know that my sister and I, you see a picture of my sister, we were together at all times. This didn't happen. Happened only one in hundreds of thousands. Siblings were separated at all times, found each other. We were together at all times. Doesn't it mean something? Who was it? Who gave it to me? Hashem.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us. On behalf of our community and our shul, I just want to thank you so much for sharing your story and your incredibly powerful and inspirational message of faith. And it's something I think that all of us will be affected by for many, many years and pass on to many generations to come. Thank you, everyone, for coming.